Hello, I'm Becca, the owner of Meet Cute Romance Bookshop, and this is the Meet Cute Book Pod. Long time no see. We are back. It's season two, and we are starting off with a bit of romance history because we love context. Today, we have my chat with archivist and romance historian Steve Amidown, an archivist by training and collector and historian of the romance genre by interest. Steve spent 5 years working with popular culture collections at a Midwestern university, where he first encountered the many ways the history of the romance genre in the 20th century intersects with the broader culture. He keeps a romance history blog, and his work has been featured in Texas Monthly, Men's Health, and on a variety of podcasts. He was also awarded the 2019 Librarian of the Year Award by RWA, the Romance Writers of America, before RWA bit the dust. But that's a different episode. I was delighted to get Steve on the podcast because so much of what I know about the history of romance as a genre, I've learned from his work. I hope this is both accessible and as interesting to everyone else as it is to me, a big nerd. As a note, I sat down with Steve in December 2023, so when we talk about this year, we do actually mean 2023, which is now somehow last year. And now, through the magic of podcasting, here's my conversation with romance historian Steve Amidown. Thank you so much for joining me. I am so excited to chat. I have learned so much about romance history from your work, so I'm really excited to get to talk.
That's really flattering. Thank you. And, you know, I feel like it's a history that deserves telling. And I've been lucky enough to come across all of this information over the years. So I love sharing it and getting people interested in it. Because obviously so many people read within the genre. It's nice to be able to understand it a little better, I think. I think so much of it reflects sort of the evolution of gender roles, especially sort of during the last half of the 20th. Century that I think it does sort of understanding the history does serve this kind of layered purpose of not only understanding the genre but sort of understanding a part of society that we maybe haven't talked about as much. I don't think.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's interesting on three or four levels at least. All right, a little bit about you. Let's back up. Do you remember? Before you got invested in genre romance as sort of an academic study, do you remember how you had encountered it in the world before that?
I mean, growing up, I was always a genre reader. So I read a lot of science fiction, read a lot of mysteries. And I remember, as I think a lot of people in their 40s do, like their grandmother's paper bag of romance novels. And I do remember as a teenager sneaking a few and, you know, kind of reading them. I think they were Silhouette Desires, which in retrospect makes me think differently of my grandmother. I don't know. So I've always been open to sort of genre storytelling and, you know, the idea of, you know how A and B are, but it's the journey. So I've always been interested in that. So when I started at Bowling Green State University in 2016 as an archivist there, I kind of got to know the romance collection pretty quickly, and I became really curious about it and started reading within the genre. My wife has been a romance reader for a long time, so I kind of went to her and got a reading list and got really hooked on it. You know, I think it's a genre of sort of hope and feelings, and I don't see why anyone would not want to read within sort of that framework sometimes. I mean, maybe it's not the only thing you read, but like, sometimes you need to feel cozy and like happy and understand that happily ever afters are possible.
Yeah, I read widely in a number of genres too, but in particular when I was an attorney doing some pretty intense work, I pretty much exclusively read genre romance because I was just like, sometimes nice things happen to people, right? Like good things also happen. It really served that function.
Yeah. And like, I know when I was in grad school, in library school, I could not read casually except for comics and graphic novels. Like we all need those sort of outlets that are totally different from our real lives.
you are an archivist by training, a librarian and yes. an archivist. So what did your work at Bowling Green sort of look like? What did that end up being for you?
So I was doing a combination of things. And as any academic librarian will tell you, a combination of jobs, because you never have just one job. So I was doing a lot with the manuscript collections that the university had accumulated from romance authors back in the late 90s, when RWA started to sort of flirt with being more involved in libraries. There was sort of this relationship that developed between RWA, Romance Writers of America, and Bowling Green, where they sort of encouraged people to save their papers, save their manuscripts, and send them to the university. And we had this titanic collection. It was like 150 different romance authors of sort of varying levels of fame and different levels of output. So there was all kinds of things. And the collections had been sort of ignored for a long time. And I got in there, I was like, well, this is a really unique collection. And in sort of the 2010s, a lot of special collections libraries were looking for those unique collections to sort of be their shining stars for people to be interested in as researchers, but also as, you know, just sort of general hobbyists. So I started promoting it through our Twitter feed and other social media, and was, you know, lucky enough to sort of make connections with people like Beverly Jenkins, Susan Elizabeth Phillips, some of these people who have been around a long time. And it was really exciting. And I started to understand the ways in which the genre had changed and how that had not really been documented. You know, the sort of academic study of romance has largely focused on textual analysis and not historical analysis. And yeah, I sort of rolled on from there. I left BGSU in December of 2020. So now I'm a homemaker, but I'm also doing sort of side hustles, writing about romance history and doing some other things here and there. So that's kind of how I ended up here.
Let's dive in a little bit to romance history. For folks who haven't thought too much about it, can you do a broad overview of what is the history of genre romance?
Yeah, so it's very fuzzy before sort of the 1950s. But I know we can go back to authors like Jane Austen, even Sir Walter Scott, you know, sort of Ivanhoe is sort of a prototypical historical romance. Jane Austen was writing, I think, what we'd consider now to be contemporary romance, which I think is interesting when you sort of think about some of the arguments around historical accuracy in romance. But yeah, so in the beginning of the 20th century, with the development of paperbacks as sort of a mass market tool for publishing books, all of these publishing houses sprouted up, including Mills and Boone in the UK and Harlequin in Canada, who both sort of eventually merged. Mills and Boone turned to romance in the 1930s. Harlequin started republishing Mills and Boone romances in the 1950s. And then in the 60s, moved into a full North American market where they were not just in Canada, but in the States as well. And they kind of exploded in popularity. We sort of get hung up on this idea of Harlequin as being this perennial company, but you had companies like Avon and Dell, who, you know, we know now as publishers, who were publishing romance back in the 40s and 50s as well, alongside their other specialties. Avon specialized in science fiction and mysteries, and Dell focused on mysteries almost exclusively until they began printing romance in the mid-50s, late 40s, early to mid-50s. And so, yeah, there's this sort of complicated history where all these companies sort of start banging against each other, and some are reprinting other companies' books.
Okay, as we're talking about all of these Harlequins and Avons and Dells, this advent of paperback books being a thing that could be produced, something that people could buy much more inexpensively. What am I picturing? What did these books look like, and where were people getting them?
Yeah, so they were all sort of ephemeral. They were books you'd pick up at the drugstore. You know, you'd have like your Mickey Spillane novel next to a Harlequin book or something like that. So it was this real mix. And I think for that first, you know, 50 years of a company like Harlequin or Mills and Boone, you know, whether they were bestsellers or not is sort of debatable, but they were immensely popular among the people who read them. You know, the sort of voracious readers kind of built this behemoth.
Okay. And a lot of the books that were being sold in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s as genre romances were what we call categories, which still exist today, which I understand to be sort of a designated line of books that have a number of things in common so that you can go into it with a certain level of expectation that will be met. So maybe it's a Harlequin intrigue and you know it's a romantic suspense, or it's a Silhouette Desire and you know sort of approximately how steamy that book is going to be, or, you know, a Candlelight Ecstasy, etc. Can you talk a little bit about the birth of category romances and their place in the genre's history?
So category romance was sort of, in some ways, the invention of Mills and Boone in the UK, where they would basically, they would give authors a word limit. They would say, I want to say for their like Mills and Boone romance line, I think it was 50,000 words. So they're these very short, very tight books. So Mills and Boone kind of kicked it off, but then you also had others. Avon in the 1970s, 60s and 70s was publishing Gothic romances that were in the same mold where they were 50,000 words. That's where you start to see the woman on the cover running away from the house with the one light in the window. These were sort of shorter than the long history of Gothic romance before it, but they were very popular, and nurse romances were also a huge thing in the 50s and 60s. For publishers like Dell and Signet. And so with paperbacks, it offered this way to print a very short book, run a very large run of it, and make money off of it. And so Harlequin in the 60s and 70s starts developing their reader, but it was basically their readers' club. It was a subscription service that still exists today. But this was where, you know, you would find the ad in the back of the women's magazine that would say get six novels for a dollar, sort of the Columbia House music of romance novels. And they would just start cranking out the romance novels and sending, you know, three or four a month, depending on which line it was. And it became a very profitable enterprise to the point where Harlequin was like buying up all of these other publishers and buying up, you know, men's fiction publishers. And they at one point owned a school supply company, which is very strange. That was all built on subscription for these 50,000 word books. And then as you get into the 1970s with the birth of sort of historical romance as we know it, then you're getting into 75,000, 100,000 words, but they're all sort of pegged to these word counts and page counts where, you know, the publisher would say, you know, it has to fit in this number of pages because that's our standard folio size. And, you know, that's what our printers can handle. So Harlequin builds this database using mostly Mills and Boone authors. And in the mid-1970s, they finally sign Janet Daly, who's an American, who initially writes just for Mills and Boone in the UK. Her first eight books were just published in the UK. And then in 1974, they bring her over to the US as part of their Harlequin Presents line. And that sort of creates this whole other thing where I don't think that the British publisher understood the value of the American audience until that moment. And that helps romance grow even bigger.
A minute ago, you referenced the birth of historical romance as we know it today in the 1970s, which is often pegged to a book called The Flame and the Flower. Can you talk a little bit about that book and its place in genre romance history?
So The Flame and the Flower was published by Avon in 1972. It was the debut book by a woman named Kathleen Woodiwiss, who was at the time a Minnesota housewife who just decided to sit down and start writing. She had read, you know, some of the historical fiction of the 50s and 60s that inspired her, books like the Angelique series. And she submitted the manuscript unbidden to Avon, and it was pulled off a slush pile. So it was pulled off a pile of just random mail by an editor at Avon who, the story goes, took it home, read it over a long weekend, and the next week called Woodiwiss and offered her a contract. And so it was published in 1972 as a paperback first, which was unusual for Avon at the time. They were publishing a lot of hardcovers, and it kind of exploded. It was in this very fortuitous moment in 1972 when you were riding the wave of second wave feminism. You also had a loosening of obscenity laws that had sort of started in the 60s and was rolling into the 1970s that made publishers a little more interested in trying things that were a little more explicit. And with The Flame and the Flower, Avon kind of did it all at once. I was actually looking, and I think Deep Throat came out in 1972 as well.
Yeah.
So it was just really like, it was a very sexually charged moment in American history. And all of a sudden, you know, this book happens to come along at just the right moment, and it launches historical romance as we know it today. It was a relatively common practice for publishers to just sort of pepper their catalog with romances, but it was the first one that really stuck out, and it was marketed to women, whereas books like the Angelique series by Anne Golong were published towards men. There were sort of scantily clad women on the cover, and this was sort of a shift to understanding that women wanted to read these stories. And so publishers all of a sudden kind of jumped in. Playboy was publishing historical romance at an incredible rate. They were publishing, I think, 10 books a month, 10 to 12 books a month at the height of their boom. They weren't very good, but they were 10 to 12 books a month. So you had all these sort of publishers and authors get into the game. A lot of mercenary authors sort of were part of that historical romance boom. So you had a lot of men who were writing under female pen names, who were then turning around and writing mystery novels or, you know, war history or things like that. So it was this sort of birth of romance as its own thing. Like, it wasn't like a love story that was published in between two war histories. It was like, all of a sudden we were like, oh, we're going to do this now. This is going to become our bread and butter.
So The Flame and the Flower kicked off this era of longer, sexier historical romances. But meanwhile, categories still exist. They are still popular, still being produced and written. And these two lanes of genre romance are inevitably going to affect one another. Can you talk a little bit about what happened in the world of categories from the late 70s onward?
In 1979, a woman named Vivian Stevens is hired at Dell Candlelight, which was this kind of just wayward, backwater romance publishing line. Dell mostly just ignored it. And Stevens has talked about, like, that gave her immense freedom to do whatever she wanted. And what she wanted to do was take the Harlequin formula, which was very chaste and usually ended with a kiss, but, you know, within 50,000 words. And Stevens wanted to bring over the sort of morals of historical romance. So more sensuality on page, more career-oriented women, like older women, not just 17-year-olds and 18-year-olds falling in love with 30-year-old men. And so in 1979, she begins focusing the Candlelight line on younger authors, but also new authors. So she brings along some of these authors where she is just pulling them off the manuscript pile. They're not people she recruited or anything. And one of them is Jane Ann Krentz, who is, you know, has been nonstop publishing ever since. And she becomes one of the launch authors for Candlelight Ecstasy, which is sort of this next level of sensuality. So there's a little more sex on page. There's a little more making out. I will say Jane Ann Krentz's first book is called Gentle Pirate, and it is one of the most bonkers romances you'll ever read, and it's 50,000 words. It is just so tight and so well done. It certainly shows that she had a future as a romance author. So Vivian Stevens publishes Candlelight Ecstasy, and immediately the public goes nuts because they're like, oh, this is now, like, in this short form, in a contemporary setting, exactly what I love about historical romance. So it becomes incredibly popular. All of these other publishers jump in. Harlequin eventually catches up, mostly by buying Silhouette in 1983 or four, and sort of adopting Silhouette Desire as a more sensual line for their own.
And not just Jane Ann Krentz, right? That is how a lot of who we think of as big name authors from the 80s and 90s got their start, right? Like Nora Roberts, I think, got her start in categories.
Yeah, Debbie Macomber, Nora Roberts, all of these people, we sort of are household names now.
Sandra Brown.
Sandra Brown's early categories are, if you love Sandra Brown, like her early category romances are even more Sandra Brown than Sandra Brown. They're really something and fun to read. So yeah, so all of these big name authors that we know now who have sort of moved into different spaces, Nora Roberts with her J.D. Robb books, and Sandra Brown is now sort of firmly in suspense and thrillers. Jane Ann Krentz is all over the place.
Under 12 pen names.
Yeah, exactly. Jane Ann Krentz had, if I remember correctly, 7 different pen names at different points. And some of those were publisher enforced, and some were sort of chosen by her. I know she's talked about this on podcasts where she chose them just to not confuse readers. And now she sort of looks back and goes, well, maybe I shouldn't have done that because it got too confusing. But yeah, there are some great old resource books I have that list pen names. And like some of these, you'll get like 10 or 12 pen names because they would just hop from publisher to publisher.
And the publisher would own the pen name.
In many cases, yeah. Harlequin got away with that for a long time.
Interesting.
Where they would basically retain the rights. So, you know, a lot of authors you'll find just refuse to write under their own names for Harlequin and would instead use a pen name and then switch to their own name later.
And how were people getting these books around this time? These were not really bookstore books? Were they grocery store books? Was it mostly mail order?
It was a combination, I think. Harlequin, their sort of bread and butter became the subscription service. But they were sold in drugstores and things. In the 80s, as you saw the rise of like Walden Books and sort of mall bookstores, I think you saw categories sort of hang out there. I think even now, a lot of the Well, really, there's only one category publisher now, if we're being honest, it's Harlequin. They do e-subscriptions and physical subscriptions still for their lines. So that was sort of the biggest way. But a lot of it was drugstore supermarket books off the spinner racks, you know, by the checkout counter kind of thing, which is, again, why they stayed so short, was you could fit a bunch of them on the spinner rack. So that made it a lot easier.
That's so interesting. I hadn't thought about the physical packaging of them being part of the reason for the constraint in the length, but that makes sense. I can totally see retailers being like, yeah, sorry, it has to fit on the rack. So,
right. And that's why covers have evolved the way they have as well, because you had that 10 seconds, 15 seconds to really catch the reader. So you had to, you know, decide like, is this a sensual cover or what have you? I think as you get into sort of the big bookstore era, that changes. You get the flowered covers, the disembodied bodies, you know, the neckties, those kind of covers. But, you know, the clinch covers that everyone knows and loves, that came out of needing to catch the consumer's eye.
Covers are fascinating. It's cyclical. It's coming back. Those object covers, like the shoe, I thought those were gone for good.
Yeah.
And they are. They are right back in my bookstore.
And it's so consumer driven. You know, we talk about the publishers making the decision, but if a consumer buys, you know, 100,000 copies of the Jasmine Guillory book with the illustrated cover, like that's going to become the style. Like that's what's going to sell books. The new trend to cartoon or whatever you want to call it, covers, is actually kind of democratizing because there's an opportunity for an indie author to have a very similar cover to a major publisher author. And so why wouldn't they take that chance and put their book out there too?
Yeah, I also have for sure heard authors talk about how, in particular, when you're writing books that are not about white people, it can be really difficult to find stock photography that is affordable and matches even sort of closely to what you have written in your book. And so illustrated covers give an opportunity to have like a professional looking cover that also represents your characters properly.
Absolutely. And part of the reason why there were so many illustrated covers in the 70s and 80s was you would give the publisher your sort of fact sheet about the book, and the artist could take a photograph of two models in a clinch and then shape that however the book content demanded. That's why I don't know that we'll ever know how many covers Fabio did, because his appearance changed so frequently that until he got to the point where it was like, oh, now he has Fabio face. If you look at some of the early books he did, it doesn't look like him.
Romance cover art and models and oil paintings, and God, that's an entire season of podcasts by itself. I would listen to that if anybody would like to dig in. But now that we have done an overview to the extent that that is possible of the genre's history, just to sort of provide a framework, I would love to dig into specifically the history of Black writers and Black editors, speaking of Vivian Stevens, in the genre. Could you give us a little bit more information on that history specifically?
Yeah, so, you know, there have been Black authors of love stories for as long as Americans have been writing books. You know, I'm sure that is true in other countries, but, you know, I'm American focused. You know, we can go back to the 1870s and 1880s, and you had women like Frances Ellen Watkins Harper who were writing love stories. They were often writing it in an instructive religious way, but it was still Black people getting their HEA, and at a moment during Reconstruction where that wasn't a foregone conclusion. And then you go through the 1950s and 60s, you start to see more Black authors enter the fray. And you had in the late 1960s, so I think her first book was published in 1969, Ruby Saunders, who was the editor of Calling All Girls magazine, which later became Young Miss, which later became YM. She wrote three nurse romances that are basically, they're sort of a YA nurse romance, or what we call new adult now, where it's, you know, it's a young nurse who's in her 20s. I'm sorry, she wrote four books, and each one is about a Black woman falling in love with a Black man. And in each book, she doesn't marry the man. So she comes back in the next book, falls in love with another man.
Oh, it's the same nurse.
Yes, same nurse. Marilyn Morgan is sort of the running character through all four books, which is really interesting and genre flipping in its own way.
Yeah.
But she was the first Black author to write nurse romances. There were other Black nurses in nurse romances, but they were written by white authors.
Oh, interesting.
Which is a whole other
mm-hmm.
category of things to get into.
Yep.
But that was sort of the first time, but it ended up being this kind of flash in the pan where it didn't lead to other authors picking up that mantle until you get to Vivian Stevens in 1979, who reaches out to her friend Elsie Washington, who was an editor at Ebony and several other major publications in the 70s and 80s, and asks her to write a book. So she becomes the first Black woman to write for one of the major publishing houses. She writes a book called Entwined Destinies, which is about a journalist who goes to London and falls in love. That sort of kicked down a door in a lot of ways. Because Vivian Stevens was a Black woman, she wanted romance to represent what she saw. So she was sort of reaching out to Black women and Latina women and Asian American women and Native American women to sort of start writing some of what she called the ethnic romance, which, you know, is a little cringe in 2023, but at the time it made a lot of sense to sort of stand them apart. And so she at Candlelight created this sort of mini line within Candlelight Ecstasy. But after Vivian Stevens leaves Candlelight, Candlelight drops any other authors of color from their lineup. She goes to Harlequin, is there for a little while, and launches Sandra Kitt's career. And so Sandra Kitt gets to write one book called Adam and Eva with Black characters, but Harlequin will not buy any of her other books with characters of color. So the rest of Sandra's output with Harlequin is white characters. Because Harlequin and the other category publishers argued there was just no audience, which was BS.
Right.
If you're not looking, you're not going to find it. Right.
Right, like, sure.
You're not going to find the audience if you don't admit it's there. And it's not until 1994 that we finally see an explosion of Black romance. So in the same year, Beverly Jenkins' Night Song is published, which is her first book. Maggie Ferguson, who's a Black woman, publishes Black characters in A Harlequin Intrigue, which was the first time that had happened. And Kensington launches their Arabesque line, which is all Black authors writing Black characters. And they went on to publish, I think, 12 books that year. So we went from, you know, a couple of indie titles the year before that were published by small Black publishing houses to all of a sudden this flood of, like, there were 14 or 15 titles published in 1994. And so Arabesque kind of creates this new high watermark where they're publishing two or three titles a month, or they went until 2017, 2018. They were first run by Kensington. They were then sold to BET Books, which bought them and used a lot of those books actually for TV movies as well. So authors like Brenda Jackson and some of these others got the sort of TV movie treatment. And then it was purchased by Harlequin in the mid-2010s. And then Harlequin scuppered it a few years later, which is unfortunate. But that was sort of the shifting moment. That 1994 moment becomes this moment where some publishers start to wake up to this fact of, oh, we can make money off Black readers. And I think now you do not see as many single title Black romances coming out of the major publishers. Harlequin has actually increased the number of Black authors they're publishing within their main lines, Rhys Ryan being one example, but there are a bunch of others as well. So we sort of hit that peak in the mid-90s and then have sort of been on this slow downslope ever since, to the point where the New York Times best of romance list doesn't feature a single Black romance this year. So, like, we've sort of had these ups and downs, and we're, I think, at an ebb in terms of public perception. The authors are still out there writing. They're doing an amazing job and doing all this great work, but they're not getting the love from the major publishers that they should, I don't think.
Yeah. It's a systemic collective problem.
Yeah. And it has been for a very, very long time. And no one in publishing seems all that interested in solving it. I think every time we have seen Black editors at a major publisher, we have seen an increase in Black romance.
Funny how that happens. Another way the genre has diversified over time is an increase in the number of queer narratives in romance stories. Can you talk a little bit about the evolution of LGBTQIA+ representation in the genre?
Yeah, I mean, we saw in the 1970s, Avon published Gordon Merrick, as well as Anne Ellen Shockley. So you had sort of queer stories. They weren't necessarily romances as we think of them now, right? Like, they were queer stories as they could exist in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. Then in 1980, Avon publishes Vincent Verga's Gaywick, which is possibly the best book title of any book I've ever heard of. You know, so you have these sort of peaks and valleys, and then Avon sort of showed this interest, but then when the AIDS crisis happened, all of that sort of fell out, and all of a sudden there was no more interest in historicals or contemporaries. There were still readers. There were just weren't the books. And then, you know, around the 2000s, when you start to see the small publishers start to rise, you had Bold Strokes and some of these other publishers start to come out of the woodwork to at least be an independent publisher of queer romance. And yeah, now the majors have finally been dragged along kicking and screaming to sort of start publishing non-heterosexual love stories. And even now Harlequin is publishing more than one queer romance a year, which feels like a small victory for inclusion in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting the way that romance publishing in some ways moves so quickly and in some ways moves so slowly. If we're all really into reading like older brother's best friend romances one year, like there's going to be hundreds of them everywhere. Yeah. But can we get two Black characters by a Black author? Like maybe.
Yeah, it's the romance industry has always been trend responsive, but not progressive socially. That's the thing that I think when people have arguments about is romance feminist, like, yeah and no, and yeah and no. You know, it's always been a regressive genre based on social norms. So it's really only in the last 20 years that we've started to see that shift where you get characters who don't get married at the end and things like that. But yeah, trend spotting has always been their strong suit.
Yeah, that is a really good way to think about it. It's very good at picking up on smaller trends, but slow in terms of progressive social. But also that's part of what makes it, I think, so interesting to look at as like a historical study, because mm-hmm. the way it does and doesn't reflect the way it pushes and pulls with the like contemporary culture is so interesting.
Yeah, the status quo is always sort of their starting point as romance publishers. So they're always interested in sort of keeping their core audience happy, but they'll like just throw these crumbs every once in a while. And sometimes they catch fire and sometimes they don't. And you know, they're brave only when it suits them.
Yeah. In terms of reading older texts, if somebody were to sort of listen to this and be like, oh, I'm pretty interested in like reading a book from the 70s or the 80s, how do you approach reading those books in terms of just like, you could read them to try to understand how they were received at the time, but it's difficult not to read them through, you know, the lens of the world we are currently living in. How do you approach that?
So I can only say, talk about how I approach it, which tends to be, you know, I go in as sort of absent of thought as I can, where I'm just like, I just want to have no expectations. I don't want this to be super progressive. Like I don't expect it to be, and just kind of go along for the ride. Try to read it as though you were a reader when it was first published. At least that's how I approach it, where it's just like, I want to understand how this is different from what I know about society at that point in time. So if you look at, you know, an early Jane Ann Krentz or an early Sandra Brown, like there's lots of things where 2023 you is going to go, ooh, no, thanks. But if you think about it in the terms of 1983, like, oh, that feels really progressive, or that feels like she's sticking up for herself in a moment where, you know, other women wouldn't have at that point in time. I think that's the only rational way I can approach it, is sort of not playing dumb, but just being kind of like in that moment, just trying to let yourself kind of sink into that world. Because they are, a lot of them are really excellent reads, like just as a book, like they're fun to read. You read them in 2 hours and they're done. And you've been on a ride, and that's all you can ask. Like you can't ask for it to be, you know, a modern commentary on anything. And sometimes you can be surprised. There are discussions of abortion in early Sandra Brown books. They're not necessarily pro-abortion, but they're discussions in public, and you're like, oh, okay, this is really interesting. How this kind of comes around in a romance novel. And you can kind of pick out those moments and go, oh, okay, now I understand this is, you know, this had a place at that time.
Do you have like a book you would recommend that people pick up from sort of different eras of romance history if they're interested in trying to sort of track the evolution of the genre? I mean, obviously, you can't just be like, what is one book that exemplifies the 2010s? Because right. So many things happened in the 2010s. You can't, like, that's not possible. But if someone was like, I don't want to be overwhelmed, like, where do I start? What is one important book from different eras?
I always think of romance as being a highly personal genre, unlike a lot of others. So it's hard to sort of generalize that out. But if you look at, lots of people will bring this up, but Lisa Kleypas's Dreaming of You is kind of this interesting moment in historical romance where you're shifting towards a more feminist sensibility. You know, early Jane Ann Krentz is more inclusive of people like librarians, because Jane Ann Krentz was a librarian by training. So you had more career women getting in there. So like I said, Jane Ann Krentz's Gentle Pirate is just one hell of a ride. And it's one that I recommend with some reservations. But like, that's a fun book to start with, because it's, you know, it is a pivotal moment, but it's also fun to read. I think in the 70s, you can go back to any of the bodice ripper giants, whether it's Kathleen Woodowis or Rosemary Rogers or Jennifer Wilde, which was the pen name for a gentleman named Tom Huff, who's this larger-than-life Texas personality. He's really fascinating in sort of early 80s romance circles.
Well, I'm going to go down that rabbit hole today.
I wrote an article about him on my blog, because I was trying to sort of track down some of these male figures, because I think, you know, we think of romance as being, quote unquote, a genre by women for women. And that's never really been the case on either end of it. So I think it's interesting to sort of highlight some of the men who have written romance over the years. And Tom / Jennifer is definitely a character.
Wow, I'm very excited to learn more about this.
You know, I think that there are a lot of books from that era that you can really get sunk into. Roberta Gellis's medieval romances from the 70s, which were published by Playboy, are really interesting because Roberta did an insane amount of research. We actually had her papers at Bowling Green, and she just had shoeboxes full of research cards. She was an academic, and so she sort of approached it in this very systemic way. You know, I think that a lot of people will recommend Georgette Heyer. I don't remember which.
I say Heyer, but I'm not actually sure why.
Yeah. Her books are deeply problematic from a point of anti-Semitism. There's a lot of English exceptionalism in her books. But she really created the blueprint for Regency romance as we understand it today. So if you go back and read those books, they will feel very familiar. Barbara Cartland is another name that always comes up, and she's a real piece of work. And her books are terrible. I do not recommend them. They have these long pauses and ellipses. She actually used to dictate them to secretaries who would then write the book. So they're very unnaturally written.
She published 700 books,
yeah.
Right? That's. Like Nora Roberts, who is prolific, has published under 300.
Somewhere around 300. She's getting close.
Yeah.
But yeah, she'll never reach Barbara Cartland's number. And Barbara was writing mostly 50,000 words or slightly less, to be fair. But yeah, she is a name that comes up. One series I recommend, even though it's not strictly a romance, is the Angelique series by Anne Golan, or sometimes it's put as Sergeann Golan, Sergeann, because her French publisher determined that her books would not sell with a female name on the cover. So they had her include her husband's name on the cover, which is real interesting. But actually, the Angelique books are a really interesting precursor to the Outlander series. It's very similar in a lot of ways. It's not unstuck in time, but it's very much the same sort of plot structures.
Interesting.
So there's a lot of sex on page in those books. There is some on-page rape and some other things. So there's some content warnings. But it's a really interesting series to go back to sort of the 50s and early 60s in terms of what romance looked like at that point. So yeah, you can kind of jump around. I think you can always pick up a very old Harlequin and get a sense of what it holds. Although those are getting harder to find, unfortunately. But usually at a thrift store, you can find something, whether it's like an old Harlequin romantic suspense or Harlequin romance or presents. But yeah, so I think, you know, there are a few authors here and there you can pick up and feel very familiar today. And then a lot of it is going to feel very forced and foreign to you.
Yeah, you can also pull a lot of the old categories off of eBay. Mm-hmm. That's a good place to find them.
There are also some authors like Sandra Brown has re-released a lot of her back catalog as ebooks. So you can find a lot of her category romances in Libby as well as on Kindle and things like that. So that's another way to get into a lot of the older classics, as well as the categories. A lot of libraries will stock the Harlequin monthly releases as ebooks.
We love a library. I don't want to keep you too much longer, but can you do a rapid fire round of trends you're noticing in romance? What is going on right now? What are you watching?
I've mentioned this book a lot on social media, but Olivia Dade's Shipwrecked was my favorite book of the year, even though it came out at the end of last year, but because of the strike, I didn't read it until this year. And one of the reasons was because it was about, I think they're in their 30s in the book, but slightly older characters.
Ancient, one foot in the grave. Yeah, I mean, just.
Who are in therapy and who are proudly fat and just live in their bodies as normal people. You know, there was so much of me in that book. Like, as I'm reading it, I connected so hard with that. And I think that, you know, we're starting to see more sort of different body types on both male and female main characters, although we can always do better on the male main characters, because oftentimes you'll find it's a fat woman with like a super hot guy, which, yeah, I get the appeal of that. But like, you know, guys like to see themselves in books sometimes.
No, it's really true. There is, as with sort of like queer romance, where you're like, we have a lot more like gay male romance stories than like, sure, sapphic women. We definitely have more fat women main characters than fat male main characters, like, for sure.
Yeah. So I think that, you know, is an interesting sort of push, and I hope that continues. You know, I think the growth of queer romance is really important. I think that at least I'm noticing more indie romance authors getting snapped up by publishers.
Oh yeah, it's an epidemic.
Yeah, which I think is good and bad, right? Like, as long as they are able to continue indie publishing, like, I think that's a good thing, because it puts more books in hands. You know, and going back to libraries are not able to as easily buy indie romance, so they're looking for the major publishers to sort of get some of these new voices in. You know, I think Harlequin's Afterglow line, which is starting next year.
I'm so fascinated by the Afterglow line. Which
I think it'll be really interesting.
It's a category line, technically, but it is, A, it's getting illustrated covers. They're very, yeah, cute. And B, it was pushed through to me as a buyer in their main bookselling catalog, which their other category lines are not.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it seems like they're winding down Harlequin Desire, and it seems like Afterglow is the quote unquote replacement. So I'm curious to see how that goes. I think that a lot of Harlequin's arabesque authors that they held on to went into Desire. And so I hope that this isn't just a further winnowing of their Black author pool. So I hope to see, you know, some of those folks in Afterglow as well, in addition to some of the new voices who are getting actual trade paperback edition, or what are, they're getting paperback editions.
So they are trade paperbacks, which again, yeah, is like, I can,
that's,
stop,
fascinating,
these.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, this, if I put on the shelf, is somebody who is not like steeped in romance publishing will not know, right, that this is any different than any other trade paperback.
Right.
They won't be like, oh, it's a category. They're gonna be like, oh, look, a book with a cute cover.
Yeah, so it's real progress from them, I think, in a lot of ways. Like, it's not hiding all the queer authors in Karina Press or, you know, doing all these other things. So
you mean they're e-publishing first, digital first line, where all the queer books go?
Yeah, it's a mystery how they all end up there. Yeah, so I think it's really interesting. I've also seen at least one example of an author who traditionally writes straight romance writing a queer romance. So it'll be interesting to see if that becomes a trend where, you know, some of these authors kind of start spreading their wings. Although with that, I always wonder whose voice isn't getting heard, you know, instead of this established Harlequin author writing sort of outside of their typical lane.
Yeah. Although I do also think I have seen that too. And I think there are a lot of writers who maybe would have loved for that to have been their lane originally and didn't feel like it could be. And now they're being able to like also write queer romance. And like, that's really exciting for everybody, I think.
Yeah. And I think it'll be interesting to sort of watch and see if that becomes a thing, because that was how a lot of Black authors entered romance in the 90s, was they were writing white stories until they finally got a chance to write for, whether it was Arabesque or Signet or some of these other companies that finally decided they were worth the risk. So yeah, I think there's a lot of progress. There's a lot of regression I've seen over the last 3 or 4 years away from Black authors as sort of keystone authors for companies, which I think is unfortunate. You know, some of that is authors moving on, but there are authors who moved on because they felt they weren't welcome. So yeah, so I think there's a lot to look forward to within romance, although, you know, I'm always ready for more change.
Yeah, I think that's more or less how I feel. There's a lot of exciting stuff happening at the margins, and the more it cannot be at the margins,
right,
the better.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much. This has been fun. I could keep asking you questions about romance history for like 12 podcasts, so I will let you go. I mean, look, I find this so fascinating. I was a theater major in college, but I always read plays in contemporary context. So I was like I was like Shakespeare and also Renaissance studies. So it was almost like,
okay,
it was like reading it as a contemporary piece of popular culture more than, I mean, also literature. But yeah, it's fast. I love this stuff.
And there's always, you know, it's an onion. There's always another layer.
It just keeps going. We didn't even touch on like history of Native American characters in romance and like Shake romances and like all sorts of, there is a lot going on there.
There's a whole lot.
Maybe another time.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
But until then, where can people find you if they want more of your thoughts on romance history?
Sure. So I write a semi-regular blog at my website, romancehistory.com, where I try to sort of put some of these bigger thoughts into some context, both historical and present. I'm on Blue Sky as Stegan.bluesky.social. Also on Instagram as Romance Historian and on YouTube as Romance Historian.
All right. Well, thank you so much again.
This has been so much fun. Let's do it again sometime.
And there you have it. A huge thank you to Steve Amidown for diving into this enormous topic with me. If this conversation has made you want to learn more, you can follow Steve on Instagram and YouTube at Romance Historian, on Blue Sky at Stegan, Stegan, and on his blog, romancehistory.com. I'm thinking about picking up Gentle Pirate, the category debut of romance powerhouse Jane Ann Krentz. It is, contrary to what you might think, not about an actual pirate, but a workplace romance about a library reorg. If that sounds fun, pick up a copy yourself, and maybe I'll be back with a recap episode. If you've been enjoying this podcast, I would so appreciate it if you could take a moment to rate and review it on the podcast listening platform of your choosing. It helps other people find us, and that helps us keep making podcasts. That's all for this episode of the Meet Cute Book Pod. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm Becca, the owner of Meet Cute Romance Bookshop in San Diego, California. And I hope you'll tune back in for more deep dives into romance writing, reading, and publishing.